in recess for 10 minutes.
You may be seated. Thank you. The next file set for oral argument is Leslie Torgerson versus Terry Torgerson. We have Tom Welk, who will be arguing on behalf of the appellant, and Craig Ash also appears on behalf of appellant, and Gordon Nielsen will be arguing for appellee. Each side will have 15 minutes, and then Mr. Welk, you have a five-minute rebuttal. You may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, Mr. Nielsen, Mr. Ash. My name is Tom Wilka from Sioux Falls, and I'm here representing Leslie Torgerson, the appellant, appealing the circuit court order dismissing his state court divorce action in favor of a tribal order that had been entered, which had denied Les's tribal court motion to dismiss the tribal action that had been started by his wife, Terry Torgerson. And in that motion to dismiss, he did not appear. His attorney, Mr. Ash, only appeared specially to bring on the motion to dismiss, which in order to contest the jurisdiction, that was the only option they had, because if they had appeared, that would have been a waiver of that objection to the jurisdiction. And the only alternative to that was a default judgment. So the parties have briefed multiple issues here, but virtually all of them can be decided on the basis of jurisdiction. There was no personal jurisdiction over Les Torgerson in tribal court. The summons that was issued by Mr. Nielsen. The tribal code requires that the summons be issued by the clerk of court. The tribal code also requires that the summons state concisely the grounds for the divorce based on what the complaint had said, which was already filed. That summons did not state that. The tribal rule is almost identical to Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 4, which is exactly the procedure we follow in federal court. First, we file our complaint, then the clerk issues the summons, and then the lawsuit is commenced. Very different from what we do in South Dakota Circuit Court, where we serve and then file, and the lawyers prepare the summons.
But the tribal court found that it had jurisdiction, correct?
It made that finding.
So that would have been an argument that would have been appropriately made before the tribal court, that the summons was not an appropriate summons under your rules.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And was that argument presented to the tribal court before they entered their order accepting jurisdiction?
Yes. Okay. Yes, that was the whole issue that revolved around the January 10, 2022 hearing. And the tribal judge entered her order the same day and made multiple mistakes in that order. She had issued three findings of fact and two conclusions of law, which included several different mistakes. One of which was that there was jurisdiction with the tribal court because Les Torgerson was employed by a tribal entity. Not true. Never true. He had never been employed by a tribal entity. He was not then. And there's no indication of how that information got to the tribal judge. We don't know where it came from. She likely misunderstood something that was said in the argument.
So was the circuit court obligated to accept the tribal court's ruling? And if not, explain to us your argument as to why it did not.
Well, the circuit court also made several clearly erroneous findings of fact. But it was not obligated to accept the tribal court's ruling. There are two theories by which it can do that. One is comity, and the other is full faith and credit. The full faith and credit cannot be given if the initial court that the circuit court is reviewing never had personal jurisdiction. There's no jurisdiction for that tribal court to even issue an order involving Les Torgerson. The second one is comedy, and that's governed by SDCL 1-1-25. There was no finding whatsoever in the circuit court's findings of fact and conclusions of law addressing comedy.
Did you request the court to do that, the circuit court, to analyze it under the comedy factors, the statute?
That wasn't requested by Les Torgerson. I wasn't involved in, but it wasn't requested at that time. But it's not his burden to do that. 1125 clearly says that it is the proponent who wants the circuit court to afford comedy to another court.
And I asked that probably in the wrong manner, but did you ask the court to look at it under those factors and decide not to recognize the order?
Yes, that was addressed, as was full faith and credit in the argument. The statute requires, in order to for the circuit court to afford the other court's judgment comedy, that the five factors, all five, it's a conjunctive statute, be proven by clear and convincing evidence. There was no evidence offered.
And so when you opened your remarks and you said, hey, there's no jurisdiction, you're putting that, I understood it to be, in the 1125 factor analysis, because jurisdiction is part of the comity analysis.
It is.
And so that would be a subset of that, and if there's no jurisdiction, there's no comity, it doesn't get recognized, and that's how you win.
Well, none of the other factors were proven either, none of them. They were 0 for 5 on the 1125 factors. And there's no full faith and credit if there's no jurisdiction. And the other criterion in full faith and credit is fully and fairly litigated. It wasn't fully and fairly litigated in tribal court.
I was asking a question. You had brought up the alleged defect about failing to serve the summons issued by the tribal clerk of court. I want to ask you a question about the tribal court's jurisdiction over to grant a divorce over a non-member married to a member but living on fee land. Is there jurisdiction to grant a divorce between a member and a non-member living off the reservation on fee land?
In this case, no. There can be facts that give rise to concurrent jurisdiction in a divorce over a tribal member and a non-tribal member. In this case, Les and Terry Torgerson, during the entire marriage, never once lived on reservation land. They lived in Sisseton. They were married in Vermilion. And I think that is another basis for finding no jurisdiction, because Les Torgerson did not have sufficient minimum contacts with the tribe for the tribe to exercise any jurisdiction over him. There's a piece of evidence that says, well, they conducted a business on the reservation. That business was dissolved 20 years ago. I mean,
is it potentially a third option? And the third option would be that the tribe has subject matter jurisdiction to determine the status of one of its members. Perhaps they could grant the divorce. But as I see the case, it seems like it's really more about not so much determining the status question, single or divorced. It's about dividing property. It's about all the other ancillary issues that are a part of divorce actions commonly. And so, and it didn't really seem like it was teed up that way in the briefs. So maybe I shouldn't even mention it, but it seems like there's potentially a difference between, strictly speaking, a divorce as a matter of status. You're married or you're not married. And then everything else that goes along with divorce.
Well, after the May 23, 2022 hearing in circuit court, the divorce trial did take place. And once again, because of the jurisdictional issue and the desire not to waive it, Les Torgerson did not participate. He was not even present in Agency Village that day. And Mr. Ash appeared, but only to object to jurisdiction because of the lack of personal jurisdiction, lack of subject matter jurisdiction, and that was his only role at the trial. And the tribal judge proceeded to divide the property, including property in Montana. None of the property was on the reservation. But she divided the property, and if you read the divorce findings of fact and conclusions of law, which are in the appendix, which the appellee submitted, it is a totally unfair division of property. That would not pass muster in a South Dakota circuit court as an equitable division of property under any circumstances. It's totally one-sided. But we go back to the jurisdictional issue, and the which you asked about the subject matter jurisdiction, and when can a tribe exercise jurisdiction over a non-member. There are circumstances when they can.
I thought that maybe there's a difference between determining status of its member versus dividing property that may involve ownership of a non-member that they may or may not have jurisdiction over.
Your Honor, I've never seen a case that addressed that issue. I certainly am in no position to say that the issue doesn't exist, because it certainly does, where the tribe has an interest in its members' marriage, just like the state of South Dakota had an interest in the woman's marriage after she moved to Rapid City in Wells. But if you take the circumstances of Les Torgerson and just move them back a little bit, if Les and Terry Torgerson had been married in Vermilion, lived their entire lives in Sioux Falls, never once set foot in Roberts County, much less the Sisseton Wapanoate Reservation, and she was a tribal member, would that tribal court have concurrent jurisdiction over their divorce if it was filed in Minnehaha County? Absolutely not. I mean, that defies all logic. I mean, that would be an absurd result. And this case is just one step removed from that. I mean, they did have a business that did business on the reservation 20 years ago, but they weren't living there, never did when they were married. And Les is not a member. The tribal judge also made a finding that was inaccurate when she said in her findings that the children of the couple are tribal members. Not true. Les has two children from his first marriage. They are not tribal members. Les has a child with Terry Ross, his adopted son, who is a tribal member. But that finding was totally wrong.
Counsel, can I ask you about this issue of the property list? So I'm to understand from the affidavit of Mr. Ash that it was not submitted to the tribal court at the time of the divorce trial, but rather for the convenience of counsel, there was a request that it be printed and a hard copy prepared. Is that disputed by opposing counsel?
I think it is disputed from the various documents that have been submitted in the various motions to supplement the record. The last one being a list that has a tribal stamp on it. The first two didn't have the tribal stamp. I don't know how that happens. But the... Mr. Ash absolutely did not offer that as an exhibit or submit it to the court. You know, he submitted the affidavit and he submitted his various arguments in that affidavit, but no, he did not submit that to the court whatsoever. There's also a dispute in here about the standard of review. The appellee argues that the standard of review is the more relaxed standard of review of do the findings or the findings of fact support the conclusions of law rather than clearly erroneous, because Mr. Ash failed to object to proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law. That did not happen. He did not receive proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law, and there's a lot of documentary back and forth in the record now about that. But if you look at the electronic record, it shows that when the proposed order was served, it was served by serve and file. When the findings of fact and conclusions of law were first filed, they were done only by file, not by serve and file. I've learned all this recently because my assistant does that for me, but she walked me through it. And you have to, somebody has to, take an affirmative step to move the Odyssey system from the default position of serve and file down to file only. Now, I'm not saying that that was done intentionally. Probably a clerical error. But the fact of the matter is, Mr. Ash never received proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law, was never given an opportunity to object, and the first he knew is when they were served on him.
Are they necessary in a case like this on a motion to dismiss? Are they necessary at all?
Well, in many cases they wouldn't be, but if in fact the idea is to have the court acknowledge the tribal order by comity, then findings of fact and conclusions of law are necessary, apparently also with full faith and credit. I mean, this is not your usual failure to state a claim motion to dismiss.
Thank you, Mr. Wilkins. Mr. Nielsen, you may proceed with your argument. Before you get started, I want to follow up on Justice Salter's question about, you know, maybe this difference between granting a divorce and dividing property. There's no property on, as I understand it, on the reservation or within trust property. How does the tribal court enforce that? And maybe I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, but
no, I'm ready for it.
I'm just asking you. It seems like a real practical problem.
Sure, I'm just hoping my clock starts going here. But there we go. Thank you for the question, and I think it's a very appropriate question, and it's a two-part question, and I think this court has addressed that question in the past. If you look at the first Wells v. Wells case, the 1990. Wells v. Wells case. In that case, the Supreme Court said that the state had jurisdiction to make a determination as far as status of the couple, but they reserved ruling on issues of personal judgment. It's in the bottom of that 1990 Wells v. Wells case. And, you know, as far as child custody, child support, alimony, we're going to reserve that. So the Supreme Court in 1990, addressed that and said issues of status can be treated separately with respect to other elements of a divorce. So what happened in 1990, we had two tribal members from Crow Creek. The wife left the reservation and went to Rapid City. The husband stayed on the reservation. The wife commenced the divorce. The husband appeared specially to contest jurisdiction. The Supreme Court said the state court had jurisdiction. That was like an intermediate appeal. Okay, went back. The circuit court granted a divorce, ordered the tribal member husband to pay child support. He didn't. It lingered out there from 1991 until 2005. Then the DSS started coming after the husband for collection of that debt. And then the husband challenged the 1991 divorce. And then this court in Wells v. Wells 2, the 2005 case, said you can't challenge jurisdiction because it's now res judicata. You appeared, you contested jurisdiction, you abandoned your appeal, now it's res judicata.
But isn't that between two circuit courts? And not between a tribal court and a circuit court?
Well, the issue, the way I see it, Justice Kern, is that this was a tribal member living on the reservation who argued that the state court didn't have jurisdiction over him to impose that child support order. I think it's the same as this case, just reversed. And I would argue when he appeared,
Well, then became res judicata because he had an appeal, and then he didn't pursue his appeal, and the appeal got dismissed, and that was the res judicata effect.
And I think, Justice Salter, that's the same case here. Les Torgerson appeared in, through counsel, in tribal court, filed a motion to dismiss, filed an affidavit in support of that motion to dismiss, filed a brief in support of that motion to dismiss and lost. There has been a ruling on jurisdiction in the tribal court. He could appeal that. He did not properly appeal that.
But we're not reviewing any of that, of course. We're reviewing what happened in circuit court. And so to give effect to the tribal court's order, that January order on jurisdiction, which was interlocutory, of course, along the way in the tribal court proceeding, you would have to, and it seems as though the argument was that this has been decided by the tribal court. There's concurrent jurisdiction. It was the first one to acquire personal jurisdiction, right or wrong. And we want that to be binding here in circuit court. That seems to be the way that happened. And we're reviewing whether the motion to dismiss that teed all of that up was providently granted. Which brings me to the point where Mr. Wilka started, which is, so don't you have to comply with 1-125? And as a matter of comity, seek to have the tribal court's order regarding jurisdiction given effect in South Dakota courts?
Thank you for that question, Justice Alter. This is not a 1-125 case.
Why not?
Because it's a 15-6-12 case. If you look at the settled record in page 10, which is my motion to dismiss, my client's motion to dismiss, it's based on 15-6-12. The amended motion to dismiss on settled record 26 is the same. If you look at the argument, the transcript of the argument made in front of the circuit court, which is attached to the appellant's brief starting Appendix 1, I never mentioned 1-125.
Well, that doesn't absolve the circuit court from following the correct rules, does it? Rule 12B is a rule of civil procedure, it's not statute at all. And it's not a basis to it's how you get the substantive basis for your motion to dismiss in front of the court. You're asking for it to have effect. That's a matter of comity. Why is it not?
To have what? I just want to make sure
The January order from the tribal court saying that there's jurisdiction. You want that to have effect?
I don't.
Then what was the basis for your dismissal?
The basis of the dismissal is that the state court didn't have subject matter jurisdiction. The basis is that the court, both the tribal court and the state court, have concurrent jurisdiction. That's Wells v. Wells, 1990. That's Harris v. Young, 1991. I mean, that's, and if I'm wrong, I've been doing this in Sisseton for 25 years. If that's not the law, I'd like to know that going forward, just as a practitioner in a small town on a checkerboard
reservation. So the premise for your argument is that the courts have concurrent jurisdiction, and the tribal court got it first, right?
Correct.
So in order to win in state court, you would have to say, hey, they have concurrent jurisdiction, the tribal court got it first. Here's the order. You need to give it effect.
No.
You don't?
No. So even if, I've looked at 1-125 as early as this morning, and I've argued that statute in front of this case, Bill Jankel actually did the argument, or argued that statute in front of this case. That statute, 1-125, says if we want to have a judgment recognized, a tribal court judgment recognized in state court, you have to follow these elements. What if the summons was served on Les Torgerson, the tribal court summons was served on Les Torgerson, and there had been no order in tribal court? If there was no motion to order on the motion to dismiss in tribal court, clearly there still would have been concurrent jurisdiction, and clearly the tribal court divorce would have been commenced first. Judge Flemmer didn't need to recognize the tribal court order under 1-125. This is just a 12B6, 15-6-12 motion saying that the state court didn't have jurisdiction in this matter because the tribal court first obtained jurisdiction under concurrent jurisdiction. And my argument is if the court, and I know you have, but read through the 2005 Wells v. Wells case, it's the same case just with inverse parties, meaning here we have a state court, a non-tribal member saying the tribal court didn't have jurisdiction.
So the court, the circuit court, relied on a full faith and credit clause. What is the basis of its application here? Does a full faith and credit clause apply to the Indian tribes outside certain federal provisions such as GOPA? There's a list where it may apply. Does full faith and credit apply here?
I know Wells v. Wells in 1990 said the state is bound to recognize proper tribal court divorce decrees. That's also a ruling, a holding, coming out of the In Re JDMC case.
Well, that was an ICWA case.
That was an ICWA case.
Yes.
But you just said proper tribal court orders. So, and I understand the argument you're making with, you've made your argument as to 1125, but does the circuit court still, because the arguments were presented to the circuit court that the tribal court order did not comply with its own jurisdictional requirements? That's the one argument made. There are several others. But wouldn't the circuit court still address those arguments? Those are the arguments made in response to your 12B motion.
And is so in the 2005 Wells v. Wells case, there's a number of cases that are cited. United States Supreme Court case of Baldwin. There's a Tucker v. Tucker case that's also cited. And when I look at that Tucker v. Tucker case, it says this. We might also point out that it seems to be well established that where the issue of jurisdiction is raised and determined in favor of the jurisdiction, the ensuing judgment on the merits is not open to later collateral attack on the jurisdictional issue, whether or not the determination therein was erroneous.
Was that did that case involve a different sovereign nation, or was that a state to state?
State to state.
Okay, well, how isn't it different here? Does that apply? And, you know, this goes to the, is that part of your race judicata argument?
I don't think there is a difference. Like I indicated, that Tucker case, which is a state v. state case, is cited in Wells v. Wells by this court with approval, and Wells v. Wells is a tribe versus state issue. So I think that matter has been decided in this case. It is, in my opinion, race judicata. What the appellants are trying to do is to have a collateral attack on a decision made by a tribal court entity. They had the right to present their opinion, their argument. They did that. They had the right to appeal that. They failed to do that. It's res judicata.
But again, it's between a circuit court and a sovereign nation. And in essence, it appears to me, counsel, like you're coming into the circuit court and you're asking the court to give comity to what the tribal court did without having the court analyze the comity factors, because full faith and credit is not going to apply.
Yeah.
And so you're stepping around comity and you're relying on principles of res judicata. That's my concern.
Okay. And I appreciate that question, Justice Curran. The issue is who had jurisdiction to hear the divorce. There is concurrent jurisdiction. Now, ultimately, there was a divorce trial, and the trial court, the Sisson Wapato Yate trial court, did issue findings of fact and a divorce judgment. There's going to come a time, I assume, where Terry Torgerson is going to want to have that judgment recognized in state court under 1-125. But at the beginning, on the motion to dismiss, the reason we're here, that is not a 1-125 issue. That's whether or not, under concurrent jurisdiction, if it was a tribal court matter, should be venued in tribal court or should be venued in state court.
So that gets back to my original question to you, which at some point you are going to have to come back to state court to enforce this order effectively.
And that's
because I'm hearing Mr. Torgerson saying, no jurisdiction in tribal court. I don't recognize that order. So get enforcement, you're going to have to move over to state court. You're going to have the 1-125 issue.
And
and is that still res judicata? And if it isn't, how can it be res judicata now?
I remember the last time I appeared in front of this court, Justice Byron said, "Do you remember what we argued? What you argued last time?" So I have to be careful what my position is here. I think it is res judicata. I think that.
So if that's the case, then 1/1/25 means nothing.
Well, certainly they'd have the.
How can you ever apply if it's res judicata as soon as the tribal court makes its determination on any issue? How do you ever have 1/1/25 applicability?
Well, I think the Ms. Torgerson, in this case, if she would like to get the tribal court judgment recognized in state court, she would have a burden of proof under 1-125 to establish that. She would have an argument, as would Mr. Torgerson, as to those elements of 1-125. If you did look at the tribal court finding of fact and conclusions of law, you'll see that the tribal court judge did address those in her findings of fact and conclusions of law. Obviously, that's the tribal court's.
You seem to be taking the position that 1-125 is only when you are asking the state court to recognize a judgment.
I think that's what the legislature tells us. Yes, sir. Yes, Sean.
But I think it extends beyond that. It extends to orders, doesn't it? And isn't that exactly what you were trying to do? You were asking the state court to recognize and honor the order that the tribal court entered and respect it and say the tribal court has jurisdiction first.
I don't agree with that, no.
Okay, which you don't agree that 1-125 extends to orders?
On the hearing in front of the circuit court judge on the motion to dismiss, the only issue was whether the divorce should be heard in state court or tribal court. There was no request under 1-125 for the circuit court to recognize a tribal court order.
What's to stop the state court from going forward then and proceeding with the divorce if you're not seeking recognition of the tribal court order?
This court's ruling in Wells v. Wells 2005 that says it's res judicata.
Okay, your time's up, Mr. Nelson.
Thank you.
First of all, contrary to the argument, this case is not even close to Wells v. Wells, okay, in terms of concurrent jurisdiction. In Wells v. Wells, they were both tribal members. They both lived on the Crow Creek Reservation. The wife moved to Rapid City. Then the state ruled that it acquired concurrent jurisdiction. Not even close to the facts we have here. Les and Terry never lived on the reservation during their marriage. Les has never lived there, has never been a tribal member, has no contact. There's also a finding in the motion to dismiss that, or in the state court, that he had some contact with the tribal court system. That's false, too. The Wells v. Wells case from 1990 did at the bottom do exactly what counsel said. It did not rule on the fundamental issues of jurisdiction over custody and things like that. Now, whether or not the tribal court has declared Mrs. Torgerson divorced really is of no interest anymore. The property division is of great interest. And that, of course, that trial happened after the circuit court hearing in May of 2022. And that was exactly what was going on there, was a request by the appellee to have that order recognized, the order dismissing the appeal in tribal court. It was the whole motion to dismiss was based on the idea that that order was effective and had to be given either full faith and credit or comity by the circuit court, both of which the criteria are not present for either one of them. There is no concurrent jurisdiction here on these facts. It's not res judicata because it was not fully and fairly litigated. I don't agree with the argument that
Mr. Ash could have appealed it, and he didn't. First of all, there is no right to an appeal. If you look at the tribal appellate code, which is in the exhibits that were supplemented to the record by an affidavit by counsel and accepted by an order of this court in September of 2022, included within there is the Code of Appellate Procedure. That says that there's a right to appeal a final judgment. This is an interlocutory order that we're contesting, that we say the tribal judge improperly entered. And very similar to our statutes, the party can petition or request, by the words of the tribal code, an intermediate appeal, which the court has the discretion to grant or not grant. There is no statutory right to an appeal.
Am I recalling correctly, though, that there was an untimely appeal after the trial?
An appeal was filed within 30 days, but not within 20. That was the rub there.
Doesn't that create the potential res judicata issue if that's the case?
What? No, it doesn't, because there had to be a right to that appeal. There wasn't a right. I'm actually surprised that the reviewing judge didn't dismiss that appeal on the basis that it was an interlocutory request for an interlocutory appeal without all the proper submissions to accompany it.
That, you don't think it was a final order, a divorce order in tribal court?
I think it was as far as the case goes, it was interlocutory because they still had the divorce trial.
But wasn't the appeal after the divorce trial, the attempt to appeal?
No.
Oh, it was before?
Yes.
Okay.
No, I'm sorry. You're correct, Your Honor. It was after the judgment of on the divorce itself and the property division and all that. That is correct. So that was not interlocutory. But the order that was issued on January 10, 2022, that was interlocutory. And I hear counsel arguing that order is res judicata because there was no appeal, but there was no right to an appeal.
Thank you, Mr. Wilkham.
Thank you.
Counsel, thank you for your arguments this morning. The case is now fully submitted. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.
You may be seated. Thank you.